Get ready for the Ocelli Effect.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Chuck Ocelli, and he's been known for many years as a blind JFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassinations, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Kelly. Looks to me like the ninth day of July 2020, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And whoa, hold on, folks. All right, now I've stabilized my sound. Sorry about that. Anyway, it looks like the ninth day of July 2020, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and this indeed is the show you were looking for. And I see your messages about not being able to get into the live chat room at Ocelli.com, and I raise you, I cannot stay in the live chat room at Ocelli.com. There's apparently a problem with Chatango, and that's why I use a variety of services in order for you guys to get it stuff. So we might not be live chatting tonight. I don't know. It might be an error in their servers. Anyway, it doesn't matter because most of you hear it through podcast anyway. So welcome to the show. Thursday, the second to last broadcast day of the week for the Ocelli Effect anyway. And you know what? It is that every other Thursday that we have Carmine Sabastano, the author of Human Time Bomb, The Violence Within Our Nature, as well as, and I don't mean that's part of the book title, I mean in addition to that book, Human Time Bomb, The Violence Within Our Nature, Two Princes and a King. And you know what? You can read up about both of those books and a lot of other stuff that comes from Carmine Sabastano at TPAAK.com. Now, I've gotten the obligatory plug out of the way, so want to check in and ask Carmine, how you doing tonight, man?
Well, as I was beginning to tell you off air,
yes,
I'm a little happier than normal. I'm not my usual dour self.
Well,
and I understand that people hear me laughing might not think that I'm a dour person, but it's usually sarcastic laughter. Not a lot of happy laughter.
Well, quite frankly, we've seen a lot of interesting court decisions in the past few days, and that's not the topic of tonight's show. We are going to reclaiming Vinny Bugliosi number three. So that's what's going to happen.
He's looking pretty beat up at this point.
And I got to tell you, even in the Golden Gloves, a lot of people don't get to the third round. But Bugliosi needed to go the distance here. And probably we could do a longer series, but let's not.
Well, we might have to go to – I'm hoping we don't have to go to a fourth round. But
let's not do that.
Hopefully three should be enough. But, yeah, like I was saying, I'm in kind of a good mood because – as you know, I'm one of those, you know, idealists who believe that legal change can happen if you fight, and sometimes if you fight for centuries, but legal change can happen.
Odd thing. Yeah, odd thing because, you know, quite frankly, I'm more pessimistic than you. I do not trust the system, even when declarations, rulings, new statutes are established, everything else. I never underestimate the system's ability to, first of all, defend itself and expand its own power, and secondly, to ignore its own rules. So,
I don't think that this assures that everything that has been declared is going to happen. I just think that it at least is the first step in the right direction, and it is the proper way to actually get things done effectively so they're lasting.
Mm.
So it's not just someone acquiescing to a recent demand to go away. It's actually a legal change that has a big effect.
No, look, fair enough. And I know that a part of that decision that you think is interesting involves Gorsuch. And quite frankly, I'm not a fan of this guy. I don't like how it is they, took Merrick Garland out of there. Because that was bull crap.
He got borked, basically.
Yeah, he got, but he didn't even get borked. He got removed because, this is, the last year of the presidency, and we can't possibly. When did that rule become anything? I don't remember that.
No. And I guarantee it wasn't a rule. It was, when I say borked, I mean it was an unfair chance.
Oh, yeah, but see,
It was built into the process that there were enough people there that weren't going to let him on. It didn't matter how good he was.
Yeah, but see, at least with Bork, there is this background of, I'm going to do what the boss says as opposed to doing what the law says. I mean,
sure. You know what I mean? But I guarantee you that there would be arguments the other side would launch on Merrick. Now, whether they are all legitimate or not is up to the person to decide.
Listen, I can make up arguments against anything at any time, but the point is that Bork, literally, in case people forgot, Bork was denied his, you know, seat on the Supreme Court, and he is also, if you look back historically, somebody who basically did the bidding of Richard Nixon during Watergate.
Yeah.
When other people were like, no, you better fire me. I'm just saying.
I just think everyone deserves a fair shot.
Yeah, but
it
see,
doesn't matter who they are.
Yeah, but see, the objection.
I mean, you can make the ideological judgment based on his loyalty to Nixon. But at the same time, I don't think that that necessarily rules him out of serving if he has the credentials.
Oh, no, but here's the thing. I think it does rule him out of serving, not because of his loyalty to Nixon, but I think that he basically violated the spirit of justice in that circumstance. I mean, what was it? He was the third one that stepped up to take the position temporarily to finally fire people that, you know, that Nixon wanted fired, right? He had to fire two other attorney generals, basically.
I'm not saying he's not a partisan or that you can't make an argument to say he shouldn't have served. I'm just saying I think that the problem is that some people went into that with their mind made up.
Oh,
it didn't matter what was said.
But I'm saying that this is a main argument because the Supreme Court of the United States is supposed to make constitutional determinations. And that requires a bit of objectivity and an ability to interpret the law dispassionately, in my estimation.
Therefore, that is what we should have. Unfortunately, most of the time, that's not what we get.
No, I know that. But what I'm saying
is, existing court members, I wouldn't say are dispassionate people by any means.
No, fair enough. But what I'm saying is, Merrick Garland didn't have a glaring example of that in my understanding.
Yeah.
He was just simply disallowed due to partisanship, period. And that's a problem. So Gorsuch is not exactly, you know, he got that seat because they denied Garland. So, and I'm not an Obama guy, remember. I know.
Yeah,
definitely.
No. And I don't know. I don't even think that seat, it's not like there was a specific seat. There was just an opening. He got denied, and then Gorsuch was the person that went up next.
Oh, I know.
So
I
don't think that there was any sort of, you know, like Gorsuch was delighting in that he got his seat.
But what I'm saying is you don't have Gorsuch and Kavanaugh if Garland steps in because nobody wants to expand the Supreme Court.
Well, who was first? Gorsuch, I believe?
Gorsuch was
so
first.
So you'd have Gorsuch.
You'd have Gorsuch, possibly, but then you wouldn't have Kavanaugh. I'm just saying the makeup of the court is different now because of partisanship.
In a way, though, based on this case that I just want to talk about real quick, I think, though, that it actually played out for the better.
Well, look, possibly, but what I'm saying is that I'm not a fan of the guy because.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's fine. Yeah, no, I'm not – I'm not looking at the politics of any of the people who voted on this. I don't care that it was four liberals and one conservative. I think that it was a majority of the court is the way that I would put it.
The majority of the court
decided that finally the treaties that were signed in Oklahoma by the U.S. government centuries ago with the Indian people, the five nations, which I believe it's the Cherokee, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, the Seminole, and one other one, the Creek. And those five nations were long ago promised that they would have a huge amount of Oklahoma given to them as territorial land. And that was denied by multiple governments, Democratic and Republican, for decades.
Right.
And finally, it was today ratified that the treaty must be upheld, that the government cannot get around it anymore. So now there will be a shared legal framework that is going to be set up by the state of Oklahoma with the tribes for a huge swath of area, roughly about half the state, that is now going to be considered native land. And Tulsa is on that land. So it's going to be interesting to watch how that is decided.
Well, and here we go with having to peel apart things after things have sat and been done the wrong way for a long time. So, you know, anyway, to be continued on all that, as I said.
Yeah, I just think it is a ray of hope in all of the darkness that is going on right now.
No, look, fair enough. And then you can look at the mixed results over Trump's taxes, over, you know, what happened regarding birth control, which I have mixed feelings about. I think that it's one of those things that you cannot decouple, regardless of your moral proclivities. You can't decouple it from health care
I don't want to, stop me if I go too far afield, but I was actually discussing that with one of our friends earlier, and I think that what should have happened was a more parsed decision, and the decision should have been, if it is a health requirement, they should have to cover it, but not if it is a, it shouldn't be compulsory, because then you are then directing religion with the law.
Look, I understand that, but here's the problem there, is that literally speaking, contraception is something that will factor into health. It's just
Simple. But no. I see that it is a health need if the, like contraception, some contraception, birth control pills, for instance, can be used to regulate hormonal imbalances and stuff like that. That to me is a health need.
No, and in some cases, right, and in some cases that's.
Whenever you want to have sex should be covered. They shouldn't have to provide you condoms forever.
Listen, I get that part of it, but literally speaking, nobody gets condoms through their health plans.
Control.
Yeah, but
you shouldn't have to give you birth control.
But here's the thing, again, when you've got a situation where there's regulation due to the fact that you've got cysts and things like this on the ovaries, that is, and also pregnancy pregnancy, but also pregnancy and not pregnancy is literally a health issue.
You make that decision. It's not like the state is forcing you to go have sex. You make that decision. So by making that decision, you have personal responsibility in that decision.
Okay, but you know what? If you broke your arm doing something that wasn't related to a necessity also,
Well, no, but you broke your arm, and that should be covered by your health program because it's a health concern. But it's sex.
Yeah, but you made a decision that might have led to you breaking your arm. I'm just saying philosophically. Philosophically, there's something to it, and I don't like the ruling that they put down. But anyway.
Yeah, well, that's fine.
Let's not go into that because we're already like 10 minutes deep into the program, and we need to definitely hit this third part about Vince Bugliosi. Now, we've done two other parts, and quite frankly, I'm shocked that there has been no backlash.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing. I get backlash about, side comments during shows that are not favorable to certain people who others have a bit of hero worship about, and I get hit for it, and this guy I'm not getting hit for, which is funny.
I've gotten some of the same backlash when we've discussed Mark Lane or Garrison.
Oh, look, Mark Lane, if I criticize
Mission or
other dead guys, no problem. Even though they're dead, people want to defend them. And I get crap.
What's really scary is on Facebook, there is a Vince Bugliosi group, and it's at least 100 members strong, and it is creepy.
No, but see now, has anybody actually shared one of our shows yet in there?
I don't know. I can't see.
Are you blocked, Carmine?
No, I'm not. I don't think I am. I can still see that the group exists.
Maybe you should go join it, Carmine. Private. Maybe you should go join it. See if they'll let you in.
I have a feeling if they do a Google on my name, they won't let me join.
It could be, and I know I'm not getting in. But look, fair play anyway. Try. I mean, if it's not hidden from you, go ahead. What's the worst they can do? Tell you no. Just saying, and then you could go in there and drop this episode and the last two.
Honestly, I'd rather just send them Denny's documents and say, you might want to read these.
But there you are. Or, we have some of those friends of ours who are sort of lone nut people, and maybe you could give them the documents.
Have them drop it in.
Have them drop it in there. See if they want to get banned from the Bugliosi worship group. Okay. So let's.
I was shocked that it exists, though. I didn't think that Vince had like a group of 100 strong followers that would get together on Facebook.
Hey, listen, my group on Facebook would have 1,300 members if you didn't purge them.
nice. I didn't purge that many.
You purged hundreds.
Just the JVB people are the people who were like swearing at other members and.
Just those 500 people.
Hey.
It was like 500 people. Did you know that?
Well, remember, Facebook, though, outdid me by far.
Oh, look, a lot of things went on. But I'm just saying it's pretty funny that, like, I'm down to, like, 700-800 members now. And there used to be 1,400 about. So I don't – listen, I'm not all that concerned. I don't like Facebook. I hate Facebook. I don't go – you notice I'm hardly ever there. At all.
As you know from all the groups I admin, I believe in the quality over the quantity.
Listen, I know that. You're like, if there's five people here, they're going to be good five people. I don't care if there was 500, they're gone.
I think all of your listeners are quality listeners rather than quantity listeners.
No, and I appreciate that. Listen, I don't even want a big old crazy audience that doesn't understand what I'm talking about, for sure. But it's just funny to me that, look, anybody can have a group on Facebook is all I'm saying. I bet you if you started the Carmine Sabastano fan club over there, people would join. You'd have 100 members, no problem.
Well, exactly. And most of them would probably be JVB people complaining about me.
Well.
they already have a group for that.
But then you could, they do. They have lots of groups for that. And they could purge, you could purge them, you know.
Nice. Just for the fun. You can invite me in as an admin.
There you go. Okay.
Okay. So, yeah. So, before I get to Vince proper, as we go into it, there was one other thing. This was the bit of weird thing, the news I told you about.
Okay.
So, in this third installment and hopefully final installment of attempting to offer a more balanced view of the history of Los Angeles Assistant District Attorney Vince T. Bugliosi, it might be helpful to remind ourselves that we all can be wrong or ignorant about the full extent of history. The people in it, and even the very words that we might come to rely on as bedrock. Yet just a slight change or mispronunciation can generate confusion. And while some might consider it a minor flaw, it matters. Because via media, people are often speaking to the world at large, and not just regionally. I'm reminded of our listener Joshua Cawley when he corrected my pronunciation of Manuel Artime. I called him Artime, but the proper way to say his name was Artime. It seems a minor detail, but when other people reference him or might do research, this mispronunciation can generate confusion or even disagreements when someone offers a rival pronunciation. Instead, when this show is offered a constructive criticism, we check the claim against the evidence, and if the listener is right, they're right.
Now, let me just break in there and say, look, I know the guy's name is Bugliosi.
Oh, no, that's not what I'm talking about.
Oh, no, yeah. But I'm just saying, I just want to add this little side note. And as far as the character you were just talking about, I've always called him Artime, which maybe the E after the T there is a little long in my pronunciation, but commonly I think it's acceptable, Artime, but Artime, yeah, is not right. And no, and Josh is usually the kind of guy who will say, hey, look, and I've seen comments from him before where he's like, hey, you kind of said this. I think you meant this. And a few times, you know what? He's right. I mean, nobody's perfect. I mean,
well, exactly. And I'm, you know, me as an obsessive, I try to be as perfect as possible all the time. And I think I do a pretty good job of it, but I do screw up. Everybody screws up.
Listen,
but I'd rather screw up in a minor way like that.
Right. A couple hundred shows you and I have done together.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, I mean, seriously, like about 200 shows Karma done together, I think, out of the, you know, I'm not sure how many now, but I think it's around 1,500 total shows. But I think about 200 altogether, maybe Carmine, altogether over the years, 6 years, and a lot of shows, man.
Yeah.
So, let's just say 100.
On one hand, the amount of times I screwed up, and it's usually been minor.
Yeah, no, it is minor.
I've never messed a fact up. I've never messed up anything. You know, I've never misinformed anybody, which is what I'm most concerned about, is that always we're giving the best information we possibly can.
No, the facts, the arguments about the facts, we identify speculations as speculations. You know, some people think it's a little dry because we're not going completely, you know, we have a little fun.
We're not going Alex Jones.
But we're not going Alex Jones on any of this stuff. It's not like I'm going to start screaming and squawking and then tell you to buy my, you know, toxic tangerine product or whatever the hell. It's not what it is. But anyway,
the reason I brought it up though is because I want people to understand that one lesson I think we can glean from this is nearly everyone can be wrong about something at times, and it requires us to adjust our thinking and even at times our pronunciation of words that might be considered second nature. So having offered that, I quickly want to undertake a JFK case addendum that I believe is worthy of consideration and future adjustment.
Fair enough.
The murder weapon in the JFK case is often referred to as the Mannlicher Carcano, but the actual Italian pronunciation that likely should have occurred to one of the many Italian speakers in the case, or even someone like myself who has a limited speaking ability in the language, is actually pronounced the Mannlicher Carcano.
Oh, no, I've known that for years, but you say that, and quite frankly, they don't recognize it. Everybody has heard that word for so long as Carcano.
Yeah.
That's all they understand. But Carcano is correct. Yeah. I know this. But
yeah, well, I knew you probably knew this, but I didn't think the average person knew. And you know, I just saw it coming up in discussions, and I had heard the argument before, but I went and looked it up. You know, it was likely mispronounced, like you said, by most American officials internationally, and then the press and the majority of historians for like the last six decades ran with it.
It's just been the acceptable pronunciation. I'll give you a good example of that is Ian Griggs, who was a brilliant person for demonstrations, quite frankly, author also, judge him as you may. But Ian Griggs, who was responsible for starting Dealey Plaza UK and all that, he used to do a demonstration where he said, look, this is what you have to do to take this weapon apart and put it back together. And here's what it looks like if you're trying to do it with a dime. Okay, because that was the claim, if you remember, that, you know, the weapon had been reassembled with a dime. So he did the, you know, but the thing is, with the English accent, that's also another thing, and even they do it. And, of course, words are a little bit different, you know, like I love doing the controversy versus controversy.
Yeah.
Right? Because Americans would say controversy, and a English-speaking English person from the UK would say controversy, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying either one's incorrect, but what I'm saying is that internationally, you say Carcano, they know what you're saying. And unfortunately, it is not the correct pronunciation. In fact, it would slide a little more even in different parts of Italy if you're using that word. As you know, Italian is not a homogenous language either.
No, there's dozens of dialects.
Right, so they do sound a little different.
And that, I think the important thing, and I understand, you know, people are like, it's minor, but it's just as minor as art to me. All these things matter. They add up.
No, they do.
If you don't do it properly, you're going to get farther and farther away from what it actually is. It's kind of like, and what I'm going to do is in the references, I'll put it in something from Forvo, which is a pretty well-respected site on pronunciation that shows you, like, one of the names on there is Filippo Carcano.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually an Italian name.
Right.
So that's where, you know, I mean, that's how we pronounce it. And it's that people, when you overlook a little thing, you're going to overlook other little things, and eventually it's going to be something big. So I just think it's worth mentioning. I'm not saying everybody's got to change how they say it. I'm just saying they should be aware that pretty much everybody's saying it wrong.
No, but when for 50 years, you know, that's been the way it's been pronounced, it's kind of difficult to bend the ear another way. Yeah. And I'm telling you, if you say Carcano to somebody who's even involved in the case, that's not going to register immediately because they're so accustomed to hearing it the other way. So it's just that's the way it is. But good addendum. Let us begin because, again, I do recognize it's Bugliosi. And by the way, the reason why I go Bugliosi all the time is because when he was alive, it got under his skin. There were court transcripts. You can read.
Well, I assume that's why the Manson people called him Bug.
Of course they did, because he didn't like the G is supposed to be silent. And yes, indeed. But there are court transcripts where literally he corrects, even the judge, you know, like, you know, Your Honor,
that's
I would appreciate
dumb.
It if you would. Like,
that's just dumb.
No, but I'm serious. He did it. And if memory serves me correctly, even in the mock trial of JFK, of Lee Harvey Oswald, the mock trial, I believe he even turned around and corrected either Spence or the judge. At one point addressing him and said, you know, I think it was Spence, though, where he said, you know, the G is silent and you're just doing that, you know, because you know the G is silent, but I'd appreciate it if you would. And he did that in real, like, that wasn't just for TV. He did that in real life to people who kept saying Bugliosi.
He's lucky I wasn't the judge because I would have been like, Vinny, your turn.
Yeah. Exactly. Vinny Bugliosi. Anyway, we're going to go back to that. And, I'm going to keep using the G, even though I know it's incorrect. The correct pronunciation, though, for the record, is Bugliosi.
Yeah, that's an affectation you like to do just for fun.
Yes, I do. Thank you.
That's fine. You're knowingly doing that. I'm just saying it. The thing that I think matters with just the Carcano thing is that what we can, you know, glean from it is that not only that we can all be wrong, but that a case can turn upon a small error. and Bugliosi's extremely questionable behavior and undertakings can allow unintentional small errors to affect the entire outcome of how justice would be rendered.
Right. Right. So this is part three. We're being asked in the chat room who Bugliosi was, but I'm telling you, you got to look him up. He was a prosecutor, assistant prosecutor in Los Angeles County, and you know, had an interesting storied career. Was one of those talking heads they used to bring out as a legal expert in a lot of places. Wrote a book on the JFK assassination, which I do not advise you read. It's not just because it is low nut based, but because it is just boring and terribly written, and very long. It is, but anyway, he also wrote a book prosecuting, basically a prosecutor's brief against George, W. Bush. And, you know, for war crimes, which I did appreciate, but he is also best known and first known as the alleged co-author of the book Helter Skelter and the attorney who prosecuted Charles Manson. That is what he is known for. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, and I'll be going over some of the other things as we, you know, there's going to be some summarization going on as we're jumping around. So
right.
They'll hear some of the prior stuff.
And for Midran in the chat room, no, we're not doing a JFK show. This is about Bugliosi and his very curious history, although he was seen as a representative of good legal conduct and being a strong prosecutor and a strong mind and all that. That's why he had book contracts and everything else and became quite famous, but.
So there will be some JFK material later on as far as his involvement.
Oh, sure. But, yeah. But in general, this is not a JFK focused case. This is taking a look at somebody who is supposed to be a paragon of legal virtue who, quite frankly, if you heard the other two episodes, this is part three, you would know that there is a good deal of reason to question his
virtuousness.
Virtuosity. Yes, that was the word I was looking for. Thank you. Go ahead, Cormac.
So, we should remember not every Italian criminal wears jogging attire and discusses whacking people. Some who undertake repeated criminal activity wear suits and have official titles.
Yes, they do.
We last finished the show discussing the press conference held by George Denny that challenged Vince Bugliosi in his campaign for Los Angeles District Attorney during May 7th, 1974. Resuming from the end of the document of the last discussion, Denny summarizes the matter saying, quote, "I am no politician. What I have to say may be blunt for some people. I have used words like liar and perjurer and fabricator of false evidence. I have used those words because they fit Mr. Bugliosi, and because they do fit him and fit so horrifyingly well. Vincent T. Bugliosi is unfit for the post he now seeks." Mm. When considering the harassment, threats, kidnapping, abuse of power, filing of false records, and manipulation in the Milkman case, now compounded by the alleged violent beating of Virginia Cardwell with her son in the house and likely within distance to observe or at least hear this happening, the lies she was forced to support, the lies Bugliosi's secretary was forced to support, and the obvious fabrications of evidence to prove no relationship between him and Cardwell existed that includes lying to the police on multiple occasions would clearly lend credibility to George Denny's statement.
Not only that, but the documentation of lawsuits, which he then made payoffs for to end. You know,
and to hide that there were stinger provisions to keep people quiet.
Right, and there were stinger provisions against people disclosing the details of said settled cases, which include all the activities Carmine just listed, and possibly more. Go ahead.
Yet anyone who heard the prior episodes likely can guess what the Bugliosi campaign did in response to Denny's claims. The legal hole, it seems, was not deep enough. And they began to resume digging. As Bugliosi and company responded via his campaign treasurer, Michael A. Heyman, with a statement that called Denny the political hatchet man for both the Norris and Younger opposing Democratic and Republican campaigns. This improbable claim, lacking any substantial evidence, however, was not legally actionable until Heyman allegedly told a reporter that Denny was a liar. This new slanderous statement allowed Denny and Cardwell to reopen matters that Bugliosi so desperately wanted hidden from public view and ripped the veneer off of respectability he had worked for so long to maintain.
Now,
3 days
following... We are still in 1974 here, right?
Yeah.
Okay, just checking. Go ahead.
This 3 days following the slander, George Denny filed a legal complaint for slander and defamation of character, naming Bugliosi and Heyman as defendants with damages of $145,000. Unlike Bugliosi's past attempts to intimidate or influence people, George Denny was versed in the law and every limitation that was imposed upon Bugliosi's conduct, and he possessed an extensive amount of evidence that supported his allegations, one Bugliosi did not. Denny states, quote, "Attempts through law and motion by Denny to schedule early depositions were unsuccessful, as were continuing attempts to goad Bugliosi into filing a cross-complaint. One of the attempts included another press conference, this time with Denny and Mrs. Cardwell."
All right. Now, why is 1974 a pivotal year? Not only because of the political action that was publicly observable, but, folks, this is the year that Helter Skelter would be first released, by the way. Just throwing that in.
So he has a lot of motivations into generating attention for himself.
Well, generating attention, but also, see, this is back in the days when maybe some book companies did not necessarily want to work with people that had questionable backgrounds as well. So suppressing some of the possibly criminal behaviors of the assistant district attorney of Los Angeles might have been in the best interest of the individuals who wanted to make money off of Helter Skelter. Now, it became kind of a phenomenon, but at this time in 1974, this was just beginning to happen. It didn't become a movie and a TV series and yada, yada, yada.
The T-shirt, the cereal.
Till later. So, just saying, I'm just laying the context, Carmine. Yeah. Please continue.
Well, no, that's fine. Yeah, the marketing campaign hadn't begun.
Not in earnest. Not in earnest. There may have been some pre-marketing, you know, I was only 2 years old in 1974, so I don't have a direct memory of it. But I must say that...
I was still in the ether for another 3 years.
Still a twinkle in your father's eye.
Exactly.
But anyway, point is that this is not at the time where somebody's protecting an industry or an image based on an already established product. This is the potential product, which is now beginning to drop at exactly the same time that, hey, lo and behold, I mean, how many people go to run for office and write a book? Happens to be Helter Skelter, is Bugliosi's book, which he allegedly, and I do say allegedly, co-authored, because there is a co-author to the book Helter Skelter. So, please continue.
Well, and I wanted to add, I think it certainly, too, would be damaging to any sort of profiteering they had in mind if the credibility of the author was destroyed before the product could be released.
No, exactly. And of course, Kurt Gentry is the co-author initially, and I'm just adding in these facts. So go ahead. We're still on the political campaign, and now people working with Bugliosi are calling somebody else a liar. Now, this is after, let's not forget, that he stated publicly, "I want this guy to call me a liar."
Yeah, yeah. he was goading them into doing something.
The attorney Denny, what was his first name again? I forget.
George Denny.
George Denny, thank you. I knew it was a common name. George Denny, you know, basically said, look, here's some basic facts, which I'm going to give you in this press conference. And, you know, I'd like Mr. Bugliosi or somebody working with him to come forward, call me a liar. And by the way, sue me before the election so that we can have this stuff go out in public. Go ahead.
Yeah, and then I can put it in the legal record.
And then it can be on the public record legally and all that, which you would think Bugliosi and his people, and I did Bugliosi and his people wanted to avoid having come out. But I also had to laugh when you said some Italians are in not quite a nice a suit as some of the gangsters you might be used to.
Exactly. But, the Italian criminals don't always wear sweats and talk about whacking people.
No, they don't. They don't. Thank you. Go ahead.
So as you know, as we've already established, it's so hilarious to me that they thought that Denny was the guy they should screw around with. Like, this is the guy who for years has basically been single-handedly engineering takedowns of Bugliosi.
Right.
But so yeah, so they go after him, and then Denny has another press release, another press conference, but this time with Cardwell. So she actually gets to speak herself. It isn't just him relaying what happened. So the press release headline for that conference states, quote, Mrs. Virginia Cardwell charges Attorney General candidate Vincent T. Bugliosi with assault, coercion to change her original report to the police, and a $5,450 payoff to keep her quiet. Since we have covered the basics of the account, I wanted to just focus on the parts of Cardwell's statement that might provide more specific details beyond Denny's review. Her account states, quote, and now realize that this is being given the day before the election.
Exactly.
This is when Cardwell is coming out. So on June 25th, 1973, Vince Bugliosi. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I don't want to get the timeline wrong. This isn't yet the day before the election. This is, I believe, is a couple weeks before the election.
Fair enough.
More happens right before. So her account states, quote, on June 25th, 1973, Vince Bugliosi came crashing through the back door of my apartment and began to beat me up. He was furious at finding that I apparently hadn't gotten the abortion that he insisted I get after I told him almost 2 weeks earlier that I thought I was pregnant.
Yep.
The beating I got at his hands was just part of the price I paid for not going through with what he wanted. This seems to be the unifying factor in all the proven and alleged victims of Bugliosi. If
right.
they defied his will, they suffered.
Now, one quick note here for the listener. Abortion was not technically legal in the state of California at this time. So the district attorney was compelling a woman to commit an illegal act at his behest, and then when she refused to comply, allegedly, he beat her. Is that about a good way to size up the incident as it was initially reported, Carmine?
Yes.
Okay.
That is the initial incident.
Look,
and
I'm
then,
trying to go as even-handed as possible here, but that sounds about right, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and as we will later see, that when he couldn't get her to commit one crime, he forced her to commit others.
Well, yeah, but hold on.
So Cardwell recounts the later visit that Bugliosi and his secretary paid to her following the beating, one that both Bugliosi and his secretary later denied and evidence proved. This features a habit of Bugliosi drawing in other innocent people into his crimes. His wife during the milkman phase and his secretary with Cardwell, it appears, Vince put little value on these women that served him at legal risk to themselves.
Mm.
Cardwell continues, quote, despite the fact that I had been intimate with him since April 24th, I was to say that I had never known him socially. Supposedly, I had to come see him June 14th and paid him $100 to look into problems I was having with my ex-husband concerning child support. Then I was supposed to say that I had made up the story of his attack on me. I am willing to chance a lawsuit by Mr. Bugliosi to collect his $50,000 for violating the secrecy agreement in order to bring the truth of this entire matter out into the open.
Mm.
This is just one example of the pattern of perjury to which Denny earlier referenced, and this deceptive practice was forced upon those he targeted. We know how the story eventually concluded, but I thought it was important to allow Cardwell's direct words to be heard, similar to what the Wiesels, who were Bugliosi's earlier victims. June 3, 1974, the day before the final election, Bugliosi sent his new law partner and his wife to file his answer and cross-complaint against Denny, Cardwell, her attorneys, and his challenger, William A. Norris, with a slew of media in tow.
Mm-hmm.
The lawsuit sought $10 million in damages, thus roughly about 100 times what Denny was at seeking against Bugliosi himself.
Wow. Okay.
Well, it seems in his style. If anything, Vince likes to really overstate his case.
Fair enough. and, you know, that's a generous assessment. But
well, feel free.
No,
I mean, you've seen him in action more than I have until
no, it's
I came
okay.
across this stuff.
I studied some of what he did because I wanted to see the nature of the legend, you understand. And you can get court transcripts, you know. And I had some at a certain point there. And like I said, it's very interesting to watch his, you know, it was the TV trial, characteristically similar to his real life behaviors, or was he acting for TV? Right. And no, he was not. He was very similar to the way he behaved, and that, like, that was a good example of his courtroom manner and mannerisms, I would say, given the transcripts that I'd looked at. And I'm not studied a lot of them, but enough to know who it is I'm dealing with. And then, of course, on a personal level, I got to hear tapes of this man responding to people who had called him up at home to ask him questions. There's a whole thing about that. I urge people, if you want, go ahead and read the writing of Roger Remington. There's a book called Biting the Elephant, which does feature, but is not solely devoted to, interactions with Vince Bugliosi. Okay? So anyway, and I'm sure you can still find that thing on Amazon. I know I used to have a couple of copies of it. I don't anymore, but a lot of things got lost over the years. Carmine, please continue, though, because it's interesting. We've gone now back over some of the stuff we covered in part two, and I'd like to move forward, so go ahead.
Okay. So the next day, Bugliosi lost the election to Norris and won only a single county in Los Angeles. A day later, he filed an amended complaint to enforce the stingers he put into the Wiesel's prior agreement following their earlier public statements. It appeared Vince was swinging at anyone who dared bring up the uncomfortable facts within his personal life, and he sought to reclaim every secret that had escaped into the public realm. The new damages he sought by the were $14,630,000. If the ridiculously increasing financial demands reveal anything, they offer that Bugliosi was seeking to frighten his detractors with the implication of financial ruin if they did not relent. The problem is, Bugliosi and his legal team did not possess the courage or convictions of someone desiring a knockdown, drag-out legal fight. That was actually the last thing they wanted. This legal paper tiger of a lawsuit was not close to being assured based on the lack of evidence the cross-complaint possessed, except for the violation of the agreements, which wouldn't even total $100,000. It was true the agreements were violated, but it can never be illegal to speak the truth. Free speech rights protect factual truth spoken publicly. It can be legally actionable, but not illegal.
Fair enough.
So, thus, it should be no surprise, within a week of the countersuit, Bugliosi's law partner, quote, Robert Steinberg, contacted Denny and stated that Bugliosi would dismiss his multi-million dollar suit if Denny would dismiss his for $145,000. So I just think that's very interesting. You know, I think it shows you the pattern and the style of Bugliosi. He amasses this huge, you know, like with his lists, he amasses a huge amount of anecdotal evidence that he thinks is important. And then he tries to bury the other side under it. And he does the same method with his lawsuits. He tries to amass all these huge lists of allegations and, you know, just multi-million dollar threats. But essentially, they don't really come to result in much of anything.
Right.
They're just threats.
Well, he made a bunch of threats about, you know, people not reporting things or correcting stories in the news related to the cases we've already brought up. He made other threats and, of course, had legal documents drawn up to create punishments for those that would come forward with details on cases that would be dismissed. So it seems as though there's lots of threats there and there is some follow through, but not always. Sometimes I think it's the threat for the, you know, the intimidation factor as a tactic as opposed to, I mean, again, I'm evaluating this across the board because not everything is put to paper. Not everything, you know, you have to rely on the testimony anecdotally of some people, and reliability of people's testimonies is subject to various pressures.
Yeah,
so again, I'm being as fair and level as possible here. You know, some of this, dark and dirty we're hearing about may be dirtier and darker than it actually was, or maybe it's a minimalist version of it.
Which would be crazy.
Just saying.
If this is the minimalist version.
But being that not everything was committed to paper, Carmine, you must
admit. Oh, yeah, I'm sure there's more. I am hoping this is the greatest hits, because if this isn't the greatest hits, he was a monster.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you know.
I'm just saying. I mean, let's look at the list of charges. What would you call a person who repeatedly abused their office, you know, kidnapping, intimidation, harassment, beating women, you know, with their kids in the other room, you know, forcing women to lie, you know, making your wife do a lie detector test.
Well, sending your wife to go and beg that people give in based on your attempts to extort personal records and other evidence from them in an extrajudicial fact-finding mission is another thing that we have to rely on the testimony of several people who corroborate it. But
exactly. And then once again, it's like any case. How many times do you have to hear something about someone corroborated by independent witnesses and evidence until you start to think, maybe this could be true?
Yeah, at least there is some truth to it, and that's what I'm saying. Is that I can't necessarily show you the documentary evidence, but if we are to assume that, you know, 5-6 grown people that, you know, may or may not have different motives, seem to converge upon the same set of facts, it would then begin to weigh the evidence for the reality of the assertion.
Well, yeah, and then I think there's that, and then Denny did actually get evidence, not just anecdotal evidence.
Oh, I know. He did. Oh, no, he did.
Yeah, there was. I mean,
he was like, look, they alleged there was a payment. Here's the canceled check. I mean, this guy, he got it. You know,
like Denny, like I said, I am impressed. I model myself after people like Denny as far as having a receipt for everything.
No, and this is literally, by the way, I've never seen this file. I have heard these stories. I have seen some of the documentary evidence, but until you brought it to me, I had never seen this file by Denny, which is amazing as far as it's, I mean, you can't argue with even, you know, in a lot of cases, you can argue with some people's evidence, but there is so much, you know, just corrupt.
He's got Bugliosi's signatures on stuff.
He's got his signatures, which are verifiable and recognizable, and he's got legal documentation, which is independently verifiable, in all different directions.
He has official records, like records from the LADA's office that prove Bugliosi made false statements.
Yeah, right. So, end of game, but go ahead.
Yeah, I just, and that's the whole thing, is that, like, I hope this is the extent. Because if this isn't the extent, what do you call someone who does all this?
Well, but I always maintain that, you understand, Carmine, is that the official record provides an interesting lens, but doesn't necessarily capture everything.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
And that means that
the rest was parking tickets.
No, but listen, I never looked into his parking tickets, but what I'm saying is that when you examine this and you say to yourself, okay, could there be more? You have to allow that there could be mistakes in the records. There could be issues that look worse on paper than they really were. And also you must allow that there is more that was not captured here. Okay, so you must allow for both possibilities.
Yeah, I can only imagine what Denny could have done with a crew, like a couple investigators and another lawyer, to really dig.
Yeah, right. Imagine what damage could have been done if it was like a huge organization took him out.
He might have taken down the LAPD.
Hey.
I mean, the LADA's office, I should say.
LA, and it's not like Los Angeles and Los Angeles County are not notably corrupt, and I swear, and I will stand by this statement, they have half a century of corruption that is easily observable. Okay.
I'd say, what, the third? I'd go even farther. Let's say they got, it's 2020, they got 90 years of corruption.
Look, again, I'm trying to be conservative here, Carmine. I'm just saying that if you can tell me that there is not at least 50 years of observable, documentable corruption coming from the Los Angeles County and L.A. District Attorney, you know, consistently, then I want to see your evidence, because that's all I see here, over and over again. But anyway, here's more examples. Let's continue.
Yeah, yeah. If Vince is the poster boy, certainly.
Well, he's a paragon of prosecution. Remember? Do you remember seeing him on television when they would bring him out as a commentator?
Yeah. Oh, and yeah, it's like, you know, he was considered a preeminent expert.
Preeminent expert. A legal beagle, if you will. You know, the guy who prosecuted Charles Manson, author, absolute, you know, a paragon of legal prosecution, you know, prosecutory, you know, ethics and blah, blah, blah. It was like this guy, this is the prosecutor. If you want a prosecutor, this is what they used to say on TV, and this is what they said during other public, you know, like conferences and things.
Yeah, was like, he was like the F. Lee Bailey of the 70s.
Yeah, kind of like this is what you want a prosecutor who is upstanding and fair-minded and knows what. Yeah. Let's look at the rest of the record. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Because we only got like 8 minutes left here, or 9 minutes, maybe, whatever. And I want to go into the next hour and really get through the facts, because we spent a bit of time on commentary here. And, of course, it's warranted. But
I'm sure we're going to have some commentary next hour, just because some things are going to be hitting. But, okay, so
I'm going to try and restrain myself. Go ahead.
So the most interesting part about this, though, is that once Bugliosi wanted to settle, mm-hmm. and they contacted Denny, quote, Denny agreed to the dismissal on the condition that he would get a retraction from Bugliosi's campaign treasurer, Michael Heyman. This was done. Mm-hmm. Even with Bugliosi's victory of stopping Denny's complaint, Denny would again acquire more supporting evidence in the form of Heyman's retraction that was drawn up into the legal document.
Wow.
So even when he loses, he gets a receipt.
Well, this guy is... You know, you can't say that he's not, what would be the correct word here?
Persistent?
Persistence is good, tenacious is good, but what is it when you're like,
relentless? You know,
like really anal retentive about collecting all the records for everything? Like, you and I have both known people, and actually you're kind of like this, where you'll collect stuff.
Yeah.
But you know that there are people that are expert at that game. Where it's like, yeah, remember 2 years ago when we went to a restaurant, here's the receipt kind of person?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what to call that, but definitely this guy is that. You know what I mean? It's just...
Yeah, very, very conscientious of how he gets.
Conscientious. That's a good word. Conscientious and, I don't know, there's other words for this where people are so...
Meticulous.
Meticulous is a great word. You know what? We'll stick with that. He seems to be meticulous and tenacious at the same time regarding records.
Especially when he doesn't like a person.
Well, I don't know. You know, there could be more files that Denny made on other people he liked that we don't really have an interest in, but I mean...
Well, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
You know,
but I think that when you upset him or mistreated him, he certainly devoted some time to making sure he got all the evidence about you.
Yeah, you definitely caught a gift there that'll keep on giving. Okay. Go ahead.
So, however, quote, Denny did not offer any such retraction for his charges that Bugliosi had lied to the press, to the people of the state, and to the officers of the Santa Monica Police Department. He did not retract, quote, that Vince fabricated false evidence to obstruct the investigation into his assault of Ms. Cardwell, and that he perjured himself during his deposition in the Wiesel case.
Mm.
Nevertheless, Bugliosi apparently was sufficiently anxious to abort this new round of depositions that had been noticed by Denny, that he agreed to the mutual dismissals on the terms laid down by Denny. Those terms did not include any secrecy agreement or liquidated damages provision, but the agreement signing was delayed because, according to Denny, Bugliosi did not want the information revealed within to be used in the legal record against him during his 1974 grand jury trial.
Okay. Fair enough.
So, simultaneously, as Bugliosi was ending the mounting lawsuits and allegations Denny and others were launching against him, he was also being indicted by a Los Angeles grand jury for his allegedly lying to Judge Charles Older during the Tate-LaBianca murder cases under oath while acting in his role of co-chief prosecutor of the Manson case. Mm. The charges were based upon the contents of testimony from Bugliosi's co-prosecutor Stephen R. Kay and a reporter named William Farr that Bugliosi had deceived the judge and grand jury by leaking information to the press to influence the trial, despite a court order not to do so.
Mm. By the way, during the break, because it is going to come up in about, say, 4 or 5 minutes here, during the break, I want to make sure that we actually put, there's a link to this file. that we're referencing here.
I'll give it to you right now if you want.
If you wouldn't mind, drop it for me into the Skype, and I will grab it and put it during the break in the chat room.
Okay.
Because I always love to give these guys stuff during the show, and it just so happens there's a few guys in there that I think would actually read it. So I want to put it in there and let them go through this guy's records themselves, Denny. George Denny, the attorney who collected a mountain of evidence about this whole situation. And I love it, by the way. I haven't even gotten through everything. But there was stuff in there that I've heard about and never seen. And it was just like, this is great. This actually shows to me, you know, that when somebody does decide to get the focus of the wrong person, it is awfully interesting. I don't think I've ever collected so much information on one individual in my life that this guy did. I mean, even on a personal level, you usually don't need this much, and I guess in a lot of cases there isn't this much, but George Denny did a yeoman's job of this. I mean, just incredibly, like, this is the example of how it is you dig into somebody's background and, you know, and participate in things as they're happening and, keep your record straight so that
And Vince had the bad luck of when the Wiesel's first attorney got scared off, they recommended them to Denny.
Nice.
It was almost kismet that the universe brought them together.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, wow. Anyway, let you take the last couple of minutes here to kind of tie things up for this hour, and then we'll go into the next hour on this part three podcast, which it was what it will be after you guys hear the live show, on Vince Bugliosi. And I think we'll just call it Reclaiming Vinny Bugliosi 3.
Sounds good.
So go ahead.
So, in light of his past crimes, this one seems almost quaint. But this was the extent of alleged wrongdoing the grand jury could determine under the law. Bugliosi had an enduring advantage that many other officials and citizens did not. He didn't care about the law when it applied to him. According to Denny, quote, at Bugliosi's perjury trial in the September-October 1974, instead of testifying as he had before the grand jury, the reporter Farr asserted the newsman's privilege not to reveal his sources of information. Now, to specify for people, earlier when this grand jury was going on, Farr told officials that it was Bugliosi, that Bugliosi gave the information. But when the trial came around, he then said no, he had to protect his sources and wouldn't reveal who it was.
Which leaves me in a very interesting position regarding my view of this whole thing, because quite frankly, I feel as though journalists should protect sources. And when they have gone through the ringer for that, I am supportive of that concept.
Yeah, me too.
However, if you've already given up the source...
Yeah, and you've given it up in legal documents, not in court.
Yeah, and it's already out there, either in the public domain one way or another. What are you supposed to do now? Retract that?
Maybe it was an intentional damage into his own credibility.
Well, but there you go, because somebody might have came to him. Now, here we go with something that might not be on paper.
Yeah.
But anyway, go ahead, Carmine. I'm sorry.
Okay. Do you want me to, because I know we're almost up at the limit here.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting way to close up, is that, quite frankly, when you have a journalist turns around and basically reveals a source, then refuses to reveal said source when it's time to put it into the court record for a trial, that sort of changes things. And basically, if they hold steadfast to that refusal, what can a judge do? Well, they can hold them in contempt. And, yes, journalists can be jailed for not revealing sources.
Eventually they'll be freed, just because they're never going to get public opinion to forever be on their side to keep them in jail.
Right. You won't be able to keep somebody in jail on contempt charges forever. It's an interesting position to be in, but then again, like you just said, automatically undermines the guy's credibility anyway ever after, because if he sits in jail for a couple of weeks and then comes out, even if he gives it up again, now you've got a question, well, why did you do that?
Yeah.
Okay, so... the whole thing becomes a problem, and sounds like, you know, somebody who might be gaming out the system, who works within the system.
Who has a habit of doing that.
Who has a habit of doing that. Exactly. I'm sorry. I can't help but laugh at this stuff because, again, for years and years, I had to hear about this guy and
hey,
how...
Hey, vindication feels good, I understand.
It does feel good, especially when you've understood a lot of this stuff anecdotally for years, but never quite had all the proof to put it together. So that is what we're doing tonight on this episode 3 of Reclaiming Vinny Bugliosi. Here on The Ocelli Effect, Carmine Savastano is with me, the author of Human Time Bomb, The Violence Within Our Nature, and Two Princes and a King, which is a concise review of three assassinations from the 1960s. But we're talking Vinny Bugliosi tonight, so stick around. The Ocelli Effect will be right back.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
It's about goddamn time they wake up. Hell, I've been talking about this since 1959, about the corruption, the incredible lies, deception of the entire superstructure of Western civilization, and the incredible treason, lunacy, lies, deception. It's just amazing how much has been done in the past 100 years to the human family.
That was Jolden Maxwell on the Ocelli Effect. For more pods with Jolden and Chuck, search Ocelli.com, along with hundreds of other shows and topics as presented by Chuck Ocelli on Ocelli.com. Thanks for listening.
Humans, their nature demands competition. The rising tide of aggression shaping the world around us. Natural fear and disgust can overcome the ability to reason. Coping skills are left wanting. Carmine Savastano, Human Time Bomb, The Violence Within Our Nature, poses significant questions and considers the evidence that violence shapes the past and present. Human Time Bomb, The Violence Within Our Nature. Order your digital and print copies now on Amazon.com. For more information, visit tpaak.com. Carmine Savastano, Human Time Bomb.
The second hour of the Ocelli Effect beginning now, if you're listening live, but could be beginning whenever it is you decide to push play on the second hour, I guess, if you're hearing it in podcast form. I'm still having trouble staying in my own live chat room at Ocelli.com, but other people seem to be able to be there, so who knows, maybe I need to update my browser or some crap, God knows. Anyway, none of that is important because I got Carmine Savastano with me. He is the author of Human Time Bomb, The Violence Within Our Nature, as well as, and I do mean in addition to, a book called Two Princes and a King, which is a concise review of three assassinations from the 1960s, the two princes being JFK and RFK, and the king being Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. himself. So, both books I am recommending, and I've actually read both now. Took me a while to get through Human Time Bomb because I had to keep putting it down. Also, you know, the problem with my eyesight recently has slowed down my reading. But, you know, hey, it is what it is. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about tonight, although I advise you to go over to TPAAK, TPAAK.com, and check out those two books, check out other articles. Sometimes Carmine has articles over there that have more information in them than books you pay for, and it's over there for free. So check out TPAAK, TPAAK.com. Anyway.
I also wanted to throw in thank you to those who have been telling me to put up a donation thing. Maybe I will soon. But like I said, I wanted to give it at least a few months for people to try to recover from the coronavirus bills and not having jobs. So
yeah, and look, yeah.
I know you've been doing the same thing. You know, you haven't been pushing as hard because we know that everybody's suffering. So I you know, I'll put up something. But like I said, if you want to, until I get a donation thing, just buy the book. Buy the book, or even just talk about the book or share the book if you can't afford it.
Right. And look, canceled memberships, I have continued through the end of 2020, even if you canceled for financial reasons over at the website. So you still have access if you think you canceled because you didn't have the money to keep it up. No worries. You're good till at least the end of 2020. Number one. Number two.
I was going to say, we're not the government. We don't value you based on how much money you have.
No, but I mean, look, I appreciate – look, I'm hurting along with you. Okay,
yeah, yeah. We're all eating it.
Exactly, and I didn't get a stimulus check, so just for the record, you know, anything helps, but I understand those of you that have sent me messages recently who have said, look, man, just times are tough and I can't do it. I appreciate you, and quite frankly, anywhere in the world, if you make a $30 donation, I'll send you an Ocelli Effect hat. I could lose money on that going overseas, but that's okay. $30 U.S. will basically cover those costs, for the most part. And, in the U.S., if you get one, I do make a little bit on it. And it's not that I'm selling you a $30 hat. It's that I'm saying thanks if that's what you're putting in. So let's keep that straight. And I may have something else coming up as a gift for people who have, donated and continue to do so coming up soon. Also, when you get a hat, I usually send you some other things. Along with it. Anyway, Carmine, you don't wear hats, but I love you anyway, and you're familiar with Ocelli Effect logoed stuff. Anyhow, it is what it is. I've given you a couple of things, and you and I do our thing, and we're not looking to make tons of money because otherwise we'd be doing something else.
Yeah,
so.
Sarah, wears the shirt because I'm not quite petite enough to fit into it.
Yeah, I understand. You know, I had to order myself bigger shirts too. Neither one of us is a small guy, Carmine. I mean, we're not. Yeah. Just it is what it is.
I've been shopping in the Husky section since I was a kid. I understand.
Yeah, and I've been all around on that. So it is what it is. Look, let's get back to the subject at hand, which is the third part on Vince Bugliosi. Reclaiming Vinny Bugliosi, in fact, part three. So I hand it over to you, Carmine, and let's pack as much information as we can into this one because time will elapse quickly. Go ahead.
Okay. So, unable to make use of the prior testimony under the evidence code because the reporter refused to reveal his source, therefore, they were unable to, quote, establish a prima facie case. That means first face for those who don't speak Latin. Basically, a first face case is the best type of case because everything is obvious. You can see it. Anybody who's looking can see it. So the special prosecutor moved to dismiss the case, and the court granted the motion. Bugliosi had only survived because the reporter had decided, or more likely, someone intimidated or begged him to not be honest in court. Mm-hmm. Whom that person could have been, I shall leave to your imagination. But while Bugliosi was not convicted, he neither was acquitted or vindicated against the charges.
See, you know, there's another Latin phrase, which is qui bono?
Yep.
Who benefits? And that's another thing. And sometimes you will hear people say prima facie or prima facie, but either way, it all means the same thing. Again, pronunciation is interesting. I took Latin for a little bit, and quite frankly, they weren't as interested in our ability to pronounce as they were our ability to write for some reason.
Yeah, that's kind of like the whole, you know, focus on, you know, calligraphy and handwriting skills when I was in school too.
Right. So Prima or Prima, but I do believe Prima is correct. And Fascia in some cases, depending on pronunciation, or Fascia, okay, which would sound a little more Italian, frankly.
Yeah, what it comes from is prima first, facce is face. Italian.
Exactly. And it is the same word in Italian, just like many things like the word agriculture and agricola. Agricola means farmer, agriculture. Okay. Just saying, and of course, in legal circles, there is a combination, a designer set of legalese that does involve Latin, in some cases Greek, which is not the same as Latin, by the way. And English in and of itself, the language often called English is kind of a designer language which combines many other things, including German, et cetera, et cetera. So very interesting sort of cobbled together language legalese is, as far as I can tell. And, but never forget that yes, indeed, there are Latin terms in there, just like in the medical society. The legal society utilizes Latin.
Yeah, so, basically, I would guess anyway that it's almost as if once a country or a nation or an empire gained dominance, they added their flavor, and that kind of stuck around in all the later variations. So there'll be prima facie Latin contribution. I've also heard the term voir dire, which is French.
Voir dire, and also pronounced, again, none of us does it right because you have a certain accent to French, which is a bit alien from the English tongue. So voir dire, I guess, would be correct.
Bon mot.
I would have to ask Joan Mellon about that, actually, though, because she speaks French very well.
I've heard it pronounced voir dire and voir dire. I've even heard someone say it. I know that voir dire is wrong. I've heard someone say that.
Yeah, I've heard that, but again, they accept it. And you can see that stuff in, perfect example of that. I remember hearing that term in My Cousin Vinny, the movie, which was pretty funny to me that, we're going to voir dire the lady here to see if she's a mechanic. But anyway. Yes, indeed. But it was properly illustrated in that comedy that's kind of the thing you would do. So
what is a ute?
What is a ute? Don't worry about it, Herman Munster. Go back to the pet cemetery. All right, continue, Carmine.
You just made me have a flashback to that movie for a second. What can I say? I'm a Fred Gwynne fan.
You know, he was actually an interesting painter in New York.
That's kind of crazy.
No, I'm just saying, he was an interesting painter after his career was kind of not really great, with Hollywood.
I'll always remember him from Car 54 and the Munsters.
Listen, I hear you, but I'm just saying he lived in a neighborhood just adjacent to me in New York where his paintings were a thing.
Oh, wow. That's kind of cool.
So anyway, Fred Gwynne, and boy, people would get – he would get very angry when you went to go see his paintings, though, if you were there and you talked to him about Herman Munster. It'd be like
– start clapping your hands, making Herman Munster laughs.
Yeah, right. Anyway, Lily. I can't do it. Another character in New York is your Grandpa Al Lewis. Look, let's not get sidetracked here. Let's continue with Vinny.
We can go into that. He was another great, just a character on and off screen.
Yeah, listen, we can do that in an extra piece if you want after the show, but let's finish with Vinny first before we get to Al.
Speaking of interesting Italians that were possibly connected to criminals.
Exactly. Let's get through this one before we move to the next one. And Al knew some guys. All right, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, Al knew a couple of people. So, interestingly, Bugliosi's predecessor to the Manson case, Aaron Stovitz, was himself replaced by Vince because he leaked information to the press. So there's actually a precedent for the person occupying the role of co-prosecutor to do that.
Okay. Go ahead.
Interesting.
It is.
So, years later, during 1986, Vince Bugliosi was selected to represent the government's case in a mock trial of Lee Harvey Oswald for a television documentary series on the JFK assassination held in London, England. Or aired in London, England. He was seemingly determined to prove the official case based on the 1980s evidentiary record against Oswald using just under 24 witnesses. Despite that hundreds were present and many others left the crime scene without making official statements, and, of course, those who attempted to create myths about themselves being present.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, I think it's worth noting that he basically didn't have most of the evidence for his case.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, Vince never let an absence of evidence get in the way of a good story, so he traveled to the old world to participate.
Mm-hmm.
Bugliosi's opening statement claimed that he would prove there, quote, was no substance to the persistent charge by the critics that Lee Harvey Oswald was just a patsy set up to take the fall by some elaborate conspiracy. The files released just years ago would confirm the alleged benign cover-up, conspiracy, is a better word for it, that actually occurred based on the evidence. So we can give him the excuse of ignorance, perhaps.
You know, fair enough, but again, a guy who should understand the mechanics of a courtroom also knew that he was not working with, you know, because that was the big thing. I worked with the real evidence. He did not.
No. And a corrupt official should know that there might be other corrupt officials in the system.
Well, you know, that's always a possibility, too. But when you're literally going, I presented the bullet, and you're presented a picture of the bullet, a representation of the thing is not the thing. This is why on evidence tables, if you ever watch a televised actual, you know, courtroom thing, you'll see the murder weapon and, you know, the bloody blanket and things like this laid out on the table. They are exhibits which are entered into evidence, and you got to enter the thing. Now, in some cases, photographs are admissible, but when you're trying to enter the thing into evidence, you must enter the thing. There is a difference between the photograph and the thing. Like, you can't bring the entire crime scene to the courtroom.
For instance, in the case of... Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
What I'm saying is that photographs are okay if you're bringing them as a, look, this is what the crime scene looked like. And in some cases, juries are then brought to the crime scene to examine it for themselves. But the photograph of a crime scene is acceptable because the logistical nightmare of picking up an entire crime scene is an impossibility. However, if you want to present items and show them to be damaged or, you know, covered with something or whatever it is, you have to bring the item.
Yeah, well, what I was going to say is that a reasonable facsimile is not admissible in a courtroom. And we can see that through, if everyone remembers, when we discussed the unfortunate series of events that led James Fetzer to claim that the Sandy Hook things were fake.
Yeah.
He went to court. He presented a copy of an online document that said they were fake. And he thought that that would be accepted into evidence, and it wasn't, because it wasn't legitimate. There was no chain of evidence. You couldn't tell where it came from. Anybody could have created it.
Right. Right. I mean, it's just that simple. And again, when you even take photographs, you have to have certain things to authenticate photographs to prove that that's actually a photograph of said area. Or that it is a representation of what the scene looked like. The body was positioned this way. We have a photograph of it. Things like that, a photograph can be used to verify evidence. But the photograph in and of itself being entered into evidence is a little different. Now, I know that sounds like I'm splitting hairs here. But again, he's presenting the bullet, but he's presenting a photograph of the bullet, not the bullet. What should have been done is a lending situation from the National Archives where they gave him CE-399, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but that didn't happen. Just saying, and that's one instance where we have something that's like it, but it's not actually it. You know. And the defense is not under the same obligation. Like, the fact that Spence is sitting there with a giant poster of Lee Harvey Oswald going, this man needs to speak to you, and he's showing it to people, he's not under the same obligation. Now, if he wishes to enter...
It's reliant on the prosecution to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. That's why Bugliosi couldn't win, even though I know, you know, we'll eventually get to that he was awarded the win. Nobody could win that trial because nobody could do what was required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. The Warren Commission couldn't do it, and they had vastly more resources than people.
Well, and also, legal standards, here's a problem. Somebody being tried in absentia.
Yeah, the commission wasn't using real ones.
Well, but forget the commission. Let's look at this mock trial as we need to mock it. You cannot have a real trial if you are not given the right to confront your accuser either, and Lee Harvey Oswald is dead. So, That's gone. Now, is there such thing as trial by absentia? Yes. But nobody bothered to pay attention to that. That's not what happened here. Okay,
yeah,
so
it didn't happen. He just got no trial, and then they did a facsimile of a trial.
Missing a lot of key elements of what would have been required to actually prosecute said case. So yeah. You can't litigate this properly with all these missing elements. For starters, it was impossible. Now, is it a TV show? Is it interesting? Were there real witnesses who actually had participated in the events? Absolutely. Were there films? Did they show the Zapruder film? Did they show television broadcasts which were recorded from that? Yes, they did. But is it a trial? Was it fairly adjudicated, even in the remote sense of the concept? No. By strict legal standards, there's all kinds of problems. I just want to make that very clear. Go ahead, Carmine.
Okay. The files released just years ago, as I said, confirmed the benign conspiracy by McCone, the leader of the CIA, John McCone, and others, to suppress evidence. It doesn't prove that the CIA or any government agency played a knowing role, but it does undermine Bugliosi's claim about propriety, or that officials would not undertake elaborate means to suppress uncomfortable evidence. They did. That can be proven now, unlike in 1986.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, Bugliosi contended that he expected all the evidence would support his claims and the government's narrative, and that the defense would offer an, quote, anemic effort to deflect suspicion away from Mr. Oswald, to offer theory, speculation, and conjecture, but not one speck of credible evidence. That it was, quote, utterly preposterous that any frame-up occurred. Bugliosi, similar to many others, would present Oswald to be a maladjusted and disturbed man and fanatical Marxist. Bugliosi claimed he could prove Oswald carried his weapon into the Texas School Book Depository, despite that still never having been proved. Bugliosi then repeats the single bullet theory. He also, of course, alleged evidence proved Oswald killed J.D. Tippit of the Dallas police as well. And he claims that all evidence will irresistibly link Oswald and no one else to the assassination. So let us quickly deal with some of these claims. First, while the defense may not at the time have had the necessary evidence to challenge Bugliosi's assertion, we now do. Thus, no speculation or conjecture necessary to prove Oswald had roughly 30 hours to do everything alleged, including form a motive, in a 3-day window of incremental time that we have inspected at length in prior shows. So, first, no motive proven. Ever. No one's ever proven a motive.
Now, there is...
No one has ever displayed a substantial motive with evidence.
Now, there is one of my sticking points about people that say, the absolute ironclad case was made. Okay. Your means is a little shaky. Your opportunity
is a very small window.
is okay. Your opportunity is okay. Maybe. All right. In general. But your motive, you got none. I mean zero. Nobody ever showed a proper motive, not even the Warren Commission. Nobody. I mean, you know, he was just a crazy commie, and right? Yeah, that's great, but there's all kinds of contradictory behaviors here where you can't even make that case, and there is no personal motive. See, you need a motive for murder. What's the motive to kill the president? Quite honestly, even his alleged communist behavior doesn't lead you to believe that he would seek to decapitate the American government. He wasn't an anti-American, so to speak. In fact, he had just served in the Marine Corps.
Well, and in fact, he had, in his personal, you know, we've talked about this in some of the past shows, but in his personal interactions with people, he spoke positively about President Kennedy. He felt bad when Jackie miscarried.
Yeah, and you can check his library records to find, and that this is a true thing, that he read books that pertained to Jack Kennedy, not hit pieces, but he was reading about him, like biography, like he was maybe interested in the guy. Because he was the president, he was kind of charismatic.
And he was actually one of the first people. One of the reasonings why, you know, Bugliosi's claims don't hold up is because Oswald, not only did he never, you know, publicly say anything when he had opportunities, or privately say anything when he had opportunities to, you know, to decry Kennedy or to go after him, but Kennedy was the first one who was talking about detente.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't even have a political motivation to really go after him, because Kennedy was more progressive than all of the prior presidents.
Well, I also found it remarkable that with, you know, dozens of cameras and photographs and microphones being shoved in his face, right, that he's one of the few alleged assassins of a president that didn't make some sort of statement about
take
what
credit.
He did take credit. You know, look.
Yeah, he never took credit for anything.
You can take a look at even the people that I think were truly mentally deranged, who may have, you know, had some problems. You know, they called them anarchists, but they weren't anarchists. A couple of them. You know, the two women who took shots at Gerald Ford, for God's sake, which is a distinction
Squeaky
for him.
Squeaky Fromm and the other one.
Yeah, Squeaky Fromm and, right, the other one who, you know, her name escapes me at the moment. But either way, it was two women, and that makes it kind of odd for Gerald Ford. And you know, that's remarkable. But the thing is, anybody who did succeed in firing a shot, even attempted assassins have generally rushed to scream out to the crowd, have rushed if reporters came in front of them, you know, of course
sick
I had to.
Semper Tyrannis.
Sick Semper Tyrannis in the, you know, and meanwhile, by the way, people were hung for that conspiracy, so don't tell me that was a lone nut either, because even the government doesn't agree with you. I'm just saying that,
Yeah, let's just say that those with a flair for assassination wanted credit.
Usually.
If Oswald was the person that Bugliosi is presenting, then he would have obviously said, yes, I'm the one who did it. I'm a communist. Marxism will destroy America. You know, all these things. If he's really a fanatic, that's how a fanatic acts.
Right. A fanatic would be pleased, especially because he's been told the president's dead. And generally, somebody who is committing an act of terrorism also needs to claim credit because there is a political motivation. In other words, it doesn't line up that you have a demonstrable motive. Now, is he playing a game and thinking he's going to somehow get out of it? And, you know, we could speculate all day. But what I'm saying is that it's uncommon, it's not demonstrable. And without him even behaving, I mean, he didn't live that much longer afterwards, but he got a chance to make a few statements. The midnight press conference, the various things when he was being ushered in and out of different rooms. The guy says, I don't know what you're talking about. The guy says, I committed no act of violence. I'm a patsy.
I need legal representation.
These police officers have not allowed me legal representation. Like, he's, help me, is what I hear here. And that's it. You're not hearing. That's right. I took him out. You know.
No, and the problem is that, like you said, I mean, it's sure to say one instance would just be anecdotal, but when all of the instances are added up and there's never any violence threatened, not only to JFK, but pretty much to no one. I mean, you can believe one of the versions of the FBI note if you want to believe that he was a crazy and go in there and blow it up, but then why didn't they arrest him?
Yeah. Now, the counter argument is, of course, the shot he allegedly took at somebody else, General Walker.
But right. Once again, when we get into the meat of that, we see that that can't be proven either.
No, true.
Because, you know, the ballistics don't match. They saw two people. The witnesses saw two people in the area before and after. They saw multiple cars. Oswald couldn't drive.
And Walker himself, who dug the bullet out of his own wall, said, that's not the bullet.
And days before, Walker was pushing that story that it was Oswald because he was trying to push his own anti-communism beliefs.
Yeah, but even when, again, ballistically, it doesn't. What he says is that's not the kind of bullet it was. It just isn't. And the Carcano does not fire that many
types of bullets. He would have had another gun, was never proven.
And nobody ever saw another gun. Got the two weapons, which, again, are also problematic. But
Throwing Morena's changing statements about that he was burying the rifle at the scene and then going back for it. Really? That's what he did? And it just stayed in perfect shape.
Well, she must be wrong because there's not enough grunt. I mean, you can clean a weapon, but give me a break.
Yeah.
Okay.
And why would you leave it? It's like, here, let me plant this to incriminate myself at the murder scene, and then just leave for a couple days.
Well, you know, brilliance. What can I say?
Yeah. So there's, yeah, there's problems all over the claims that Buglielsi is making. And we can attribute some of them to the time because he couldn't have had access to it. But even we'll see, you know, later on, as you and I both know, in Reclaiming History, he was still making the same arguments. So he had access to the evidence.
Oh,
it wasn't that he didn't learn later on.
Yeah, no, by the time he had access to even more evidence, he just refused to use it.
Yeah,
so, you know, it was just that simple. In truth, in the 80s, you could make arguments that there were certain things that were not available at the time. But the other funny part about this is that Bugliosi's using antiquated arguments, and Jerry Spence is using antiquated stuff from, you know, at least a decade earlier, which... Hey, look, it's Oswald in the doorway. I mean, this is what he literally used. And
yeah, all the bad ideas that, well, you know, like the myths. He was like Bugliosi. He just used the stuff that he thought supported him and didn't really look at the quality of it.
Right, right. And, you know, here we go. So, all right, please continue because we're down to the last, say, well, maybe 25 minutes. We can go a little touch longer, but that's about it. And okay. I want to close out this third episode of Reclaiming Vinnie Bugliosi.
Okay, so as we've established, there was no proven motive. And additionally, we can address the old Marxist trope, you know, beyond what we've already said, that's wheeled out in several official stories. Indeed, Oswald presented the Marxist veneer, as I like to call it, but he never actually verifiably practiced Marxism.
At best, his actions are confusing.
Yeah, he never attended communist parties or meetings. He never attended regular Marxist meetings or groups.
Did not.
You know, he in Russia or the U.S.
Did not have a membership in the Communist Party in Russia or the U.S. Did not have a membership even in the Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
It was fake.
It was fake thing. Yeah. He called himself the treasurer, refused to identify who the head of it was, and it's an organization that didn't even exist that he was handing out flyers for on the streets of New Orleans during that summer. So, it's a real organization, but
I was just going to say, it just so happens that earlier in 1963, the FBI was looking for a Fair Play for Cuba Committee letterhead so they could impersonate them.
Yeah, which is provable. The FBI attempted to infiltrate and impersonate members of various things like the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, certainly the American Communist Party.
They got a board member of the American Communist Party. I got someone as high as that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but Oswald, now let's get back to him, is not a member of any of these things.
Never had been, even in a country like Russia where it was largely compulsory.
It would have been a good idea for him to join the Communist Party to show them how much he really wanted to stay, I think. And he didn't. So I'm just saying, you know.
Yeah, what does that tell us?
And if you go to, like I said, at best this is confusing. He's a Marine. He goes to Russia, tries to stay there, ends up in Minsk. They send him back out of there. He ends up with the wife, you know, which he wanted to leave with. He's over here. He's doing weird stuff with, you know, hands off Cuba. And factually, once again, his own actions and the stuff that J. Edgar Hoover would have been licking his chops over, not really going fully along and fully in with, I'm with the worker, I'm with the Communist Party, none of that.
Yeah, he doesn't undertake a series of strikes, he doesn't help in unionization efforts like all the other Marxists did at the time.
He's going to employment agencies.
Yeah,
trying
the only Marxist
to get
group,
work.
Like you said, he claimed membership in was a group that didn't exist in New Orleans.
Right. Exactly. Well, you know, it existed nationally. Now, let's be clear. The Fair Play for Cuba Committee was headquartered in New York City and was an organization, a small one, but an organization that was basically a pro-Castro organization.
Yeah.
And Oswald didn't even join it in an official sense.
Well, and the thing is that when you look, because I looked in because I wanted to see, because people were always saying, well, you know, he was a member, a card-carrying member, just like with the communist thing, which...
First he wasn't.
All, they didn't carry cards. But let's say, you know, Oswald made his own fake card. The problem is that the FPCC didn't actually, in its charter, have members because they didn't want them to be singled out by people. So they would just, when they would mail them stuff, you know, like communist updates and stuff, they would just do mass mailings, and they didn't want to have to provide a membership list to the government if they were ever subpoenaed.
Yeah, right.
So he didn't even understand how things worked.
No, and look, the American Communist Party had an official membership list, which they protected, but they also didn't have cards. But meanwhile, here he is parading around, behaving as though, and like I said, confusing to my mind what's going on here.
Yeah, and then, you know, we can look in Mexico City at the person that impersonated him at least once in the Mexican embassy, or in the Cuban embassy, and they had a communist card. So once again,
they did.
We are dealing with people who don't understand what they're trying to mimic.
Yes, I know. But that's the funny thing. It's like, if you want to call him a communist, okay, let's establish it. Public statements, fair enough, but what is he doing? He's not actually joining an organization, doing anything effective outside of handing out flyers, which probably wasn't that effective. I'm just saying, you don't have the evidence to support it, so again, where's your motive? He didn't hate Jack Kennedy, so it wasn't a personal vendetta or I have to get him because he's going to, you know, be the guy who brings about the Book of Revelations end of the world scenario. It's nothing like that. It's not that I have to kill him for my communist heroes, because that makes no sense. And Lyndon Johnson replacing him, not the best move if you want to work with communists and make things easier on communists. I'm thinking that on the surface people might know that Lyndon Johnson was going to be less agreeable to maybe talking to commies. Just saying. Yeah. You know, maybe it's just me.
Yeah. The boot-wearing Texan, I don't think, was going to be quite as agreeable as the Northeastern intellectual.
Yeah, I think if you're going to have a chance to, have reasonable, like, civil conversations with, Nikita Khrushchev, you might want to send Kennedy as opposed to Johnson.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you're throwing a party, send Johnson.
just saying. If you want things to be smooth, because Johnson couldn't be smooth with anything. That's another thing that pretty much the public knew, I think, that he wasn't exactly the smooth politician. He was definitely the backroom dealer. You know what I mean? And that's how his power really worked. And if you knew anything about politics, which, you know, Oswald's even expertise when it comes to general political circumstances and characters, it seems askew. He does not seem that highly educated. Now, he's not an idiot, but I don't think he is intensely educated. And he may have interests in politics and whatever else. And apparently, according to Ruth Payne, he watched football. But, I don't think he had...
I think he is of above average intelligence, meaning above 100. I don't think he's by any means a genius, as some people have tried to paint him, because that helps lend credibility to whatever story they're making about him.
No, and certainly even based on his reading habits when it comes to the library and the books he owned and things like that, you're not looking at somebody who, yes, indeed, he had probably read some things that other people would not, so he had some intellectual curiosities. I mean, again, talking to Titovits, who was his friend in Minsk, Oswald did read a bit, but he, struggled with Shakespeare in English. You know what I mean? And I'm just saying, that's high school level stuff for most of us. You know, I don't know what they do now, but for most of us who grew up, in previous generations, we all had to deal with some Shakespeare at some point. And he struggled with Shakespeare a bit. So I'm just saying that complexities may not have been his strong suit. And the various nuances of political interactions and geopolitical circumstances and characters may not have been intimately part of his knowledge base. And
that is supported by, if you look back at some of the, though the interviews are very skewed and biased, trying to demonize him, you can look at like what Priscilla McMillan Johnson and others said, that he was like a child, that he didn't understand the communist system, that they felt bad for him.
Well, and in his own publicly published interview, which everybody's gotten a chance to hear now, and if you haven't, you can find it on YouTube. I think I have it on my channel even, where he's, hey, look, are you a Marxist or are you a communist? And he says, no, sir, I'm not a communist, but I am a Marxist-Leninist. Now, there is an argument to be made there. What's the difference? And there is a difference. Now, is it a subtle difference? Are there nuances? Sure. Not going to argue it. But here's the thing. He's asked, what's the difference? And he does say, well, and then he goes into how many TVs there are at all. He can't make the point in a salient fashion. He cannot give you a concise point to explain the difference. He knows that there's a difference. He makes a point of it, but when asked to, okay, so good, explain that point you just made, he can't do it. Now, some people might say, oh, he was nervous, or that was intentional, or what. I honestly do not believe that he could explain it. He knew those examples because of something he had read or something he was told, and he started talking about the amount of machines versus sugar trade and how many televisions there are per capita and how many cars there are per capita in Cuba as opposed to other places. He did all that because they were backup points to the main point. He did not have good retention on that. Now, if this is part of your centerpiece of political philosophy.
Yeah, your ideology that you live by.
You know, if somebody asks me to explain my ideology, hold on, you better hang out for an hour, right? Because I've got plenty of things to say. Look, this is how I feel. This is what I'm against. This is how I think people should be living. This is what the system is. I'll go through all that. Oswald's going, well, look at how many things are going on in Russia and how many things are going on in Cuba, which is an incorrect, incomplete, and sort of the illustration without the information.
Yeah.
Which means he's incoherent about what his alleged philosophy is. So either
a philosophical, you know what I mean.
Yeah, pretty much. And look, if you're speaking shorthand because you got to get through it real quick, but he had time and he didn't break it down. So I'm just going to leave it at that and say that this is a guy who is clearly not so much of a dogmatic communist that he, you know, hates America and must bring down the capitalist pig dogs, okay?
Yeah.
This is not demonstrable. Now, being in favor of leave Cuba to the Cubans, or, look, Fidel Castro is the guy they want down there, let him control his country and leave him alone. Hell, man, I would make that statement.
Yeah, at best, you know, and I don't think they can make this argument, but at best he was a socialist. At best. He was for social change. He wasn't for violent overthrowing. He wasn't a Marxist. Sorry.
Now that's no the other. Now that's the other interesting thing is he did have concerns about social change. He, you know, he had stated, according to many different separate anecdotes, that he certainly had problems with racial injustice.
Yeah.
He felt as though that was a bad thing that was going on in the country. Didn't know what to do about it, but he thought it was wrong. Okay, and interacting with his black coworkers in the school book depository and other places, according to them, he was not a racist guy. Seemed to be pretty, you know, milk toast actually. At best, not really even an outspoken guy about any of it. Even the things that he seemed to have a little bit of passion for. So, you don't have the case where you can say this is the motive. This is why this happened.
Yeah, no motive. They can't prove the means having actually even gotten in the building because of the separate stories. Like we go back to Morena or Frazier, or take your pick, and they have varying versions. And Morena especially is important because she's supposedly the person who sees him leave.
Or the guy whose job it is to watch what the hell comes in and out of the depository. That guy states that he came in with a lunch bag. Now, you're not fitting the Carcano into the lunch bag, okay? And that's, you know, okay, you hit it outside. Well, at some point, did he wait for him to go to the bathroom? So while he was, you know, redoing the floors up on the upper floors, he decided to check in on that guy to make sure he had an opportunity to go get his gun out of the bushes?
Yeah. Well, and if he brought the gun, why didn't he bring tools?
Well, tools would have been smart.
I mean, if you're gonna bring the stuff you need.
Tools would have been smart. There's a bunch of problems. So I'm just saying. you have shaky stuff, and then you have nothing when it comes to that motive. So, I think I've hammered that.
Point. Yeah, like we said. However, Bugliosi was successful, despite... Oh, and one last thing. Marxists don't call the FBI for help. Anyway.
Yeah, that's generally something you don't do. Mm-hmm.
Bugliosi was successful despite the many unproven claims his allegations rested upon, and the jury found unanimously that Oswald was guilty in the mock trial. Unfortunately, the limited evidentiary record at the time, Bugliosi's claims about Oswald, and the lack of a sufficient defense would assure the trial's final verdict. However, at least Oswald had a trial this time around, if a flawed one.
Okay, wait. Because I can't let that go by just like that. First of all, They said, we're going to have actual Dallas citizens and we're going to hold this in Dallas as it would have been done. Okay, that would be a nice assertion if that's what happened. They took them over to England, first of all. Okay, I'm just saying.
They... I have a feeling I know why. If you, this is total speculation, but I would guess this.
Go ahead.
They don't have the same laws of evidence in England.
Well, no, because this is not constraint. There is no legal constraint on what it is did for this TV show, so it wouldn't have mattered. They could have done it in Dallas.
Oh, no. But what I'm saying, though, is that if they had tried to present it, it might have been found to be – someone could have sued them if they tried to present a false legal fact using the legitimacy of a court.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. This isn't an actual court anyway. This is a retired judge.
Yeah, oh, okay. Yeah. Well, no, I understand. Yeah, I'm just – I don't know. I think that there had to have been – just because of how this was done, there could have been a lawsuit raised against this.
I don't think this is
more than propaganda.
See, I don't think so, and I'm going to tell you why. Because there is no connection to a real legal mechanism here. None. That's the first problem.
No, I understand that. I'm not saying that there's a connection to a legal mechanism. I just think that during that time, I think, I'm not sure. Well, no, that might have been after. I don't know if the Fairness Doctrine was around then.
No. By the time this happened, it's gone.
Okay.
So you didn't have to.
I would think that it baffles me that nobody tried to bring, it's a farce.
Well, look, here's the real problem with the logistics is that, people were starting to get wind of what was going to happen, and there might have been interference, so they brought it over there. That's why they did it. And also it was because the company that was paying the bills was a UK-based company. So it was originally developed by them as this idea that they were going to do, and they were going to use real Dallas citizens. But, of course, they're not drawn from a legitimate jury pool, first of all. Secondly, the judge is not a judge anymore.
Well,
he's retired.
Yeah, it's a limited amount of jury pool just to begin with. They're only using less than two dozen out of hundreds.
Yeah, but forget the jury pool. Now let's put those things aside. Here's your other problem. Could they compel witnesses to show up? No. So they could get.
Not. Yeah, you can't subpoena anybody.
So when they needed, Dallas police, they actually got some pretty good Dallas police to show up there, including Mr. Baker and, man, I can't think of everybody, but I'm telling you now that there were various law enforcement officers that they did get their hands on, but if they were in Dallas, they probably could have gotten more. They wouldn't have had to fly them over to England. I'm sure it was a fun trip for some of them. I never really got the notes on that. But I got to tell you that bringing it over there means you have no connection, no ability to go visit Dealey Plaza, let's say. Here's the scene of the crime. Remember I brought that up before?
Yeah.
You don't have the actual pieces of evidence. You don't have a real jury pool. You don't have an active judge. You don't have, access to a witness pool which could be drawn upon by the public. I'm telling you that mock trial doesn't begin to tell you what this TV show was. It is just a TV show.
It was a TV show. That's all it was.
And it's a TV show with some of the real participants from the historical event involved in it.
It was a dramatic recreation.
There you go. With not all actors.
Yeah.
That's
some of the actual participants.
But
some of the names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Well, some of a lot of things have been changed. I mean, look, it was remarkable to see.
And the guilty.
Oh, yeah.
Leave that out.
That, too. But you have the guy who was a part of the couple there. Why is this name eluding me? One of the closest witnesses to the assassination who was there with his wife and children.
Was it, trying to remember.
You know who
I know who you're talking about.
About.
The guy in Dallas.
The guy in Dallas who was laying on top of his children.
Yeah.
So they had him there. He had not seen the Zapruder film. Ever. And that's interesting. So when he saw it, he literally thought, now here's the thing about eyewitnesses again, in his mind, he thought that Kennedy had, as he had stated that day, jumped up in his seat.
Gail Newman.
Yeah, Gail and Bill Newman, right?
I had to dig in my mind for a sec.
No, I know. Me too, for a second there, because I mean, long time since I talked to Bill Newman. I think he's still alive. I think Gail has passed. But anyway, I could be wrong about that. We got to check. But the thing is, up until a couple of years ago, he was still alive, still available. But at the time, in the 1980s, when he went to go film this, he's a witness. He was a real witness. And they showed him the Zapruder film, and Bugliosi made the point of, see, you didn't see what you thought you saw because you thought he jumped up. But this is 25 years later that he is asking this question. And
well, and as we know from every case, unfortunately, memory goes nearly moments after an event transpires.
Memory is malleable.
Like ice, it melts and it reforms.
It's malleable and it is subject to revision at all times, which is why they urge people to get witness statements immediately. But here's the point about Newman. Newman is one of the closest people to the headshot in Dealey Plaza. I mean, literally, one of the people who is physically closest to where JFK's head explodes. Outside of the people in the car, obviously, okay, and stuff like that. I'm saying a person on the ground, objective witness, should be. And that day, he makes a mistake.
Yeah.
Of what he saw. Because that is the kind of thing that happens.
Well, yeah, you have a lot of stress and all sorts of environmental things going on at once. You might not have a clear recollection.
Right, so even the police... And even the, you know, and Bugliosi, to his credit, brought in things like, you know, Sheriff Decker's files, reports that were taken by sheriff's deputies, witness statements that were taken at the time, commensurate with the event. He used some of that and entered it into evidence. He did that in this whatever you want to call it. But
you
go ahead.
I just want to try to get as much in as we can. There's a couple more things.
No problem. Listen, we'll go about another 7 minutes and I'll shut up. But I just wanted to make the point that calling this even a trial or a legal whatever and trying to compare it to actual legal proceedings.
Oh, yeah, that's why I said it was a flawed inquiry.
Well,
flawed from the beginning. If flawed is nice, that's fine. You can say I was being too nice.
I'm just saying, you're being extremely generous. This is not even remotely close.
It was an
close.
Abominable inquiry.
but it's not, listen, I'll qualify it this way. It's not remotely close to the standards that would be required to prosecute anything in any state in this union, no matter how loose or whatever the laws are. It
well,
would
under
not.
Criminal court procedure, not even the Warren Commission qualifies.
No, absolutely not. But I'm saying that this case that we're talking about that involves this guy is nothing like an actual legal proceeding. I want to make that point because later on, what does he do? Talk about how he did it with real evidence and real people and, you know, and BS is all I'm saying. Go ahead, Carmine. Finish it out any way you can.
Okay, seven minutes
or so.
Well, let's just do some quick jumps then. So we'll just do a quick jump to Reclaiming History. I believe that's 2009. Anything to say about that? I think we've commented on that rather.
Enough.
At length.
Go ahead.
Okay. The final thing I would mention, and this, there is certainly not definitive proof of this. There is some speculation. There's some proof of some things. But it is certainly, I think, an interesting way to end. And that is, I believe it's 2019, his book came out, Chaos, I believe is the name of the book. Author Tom O'Neill did a more recent interview, I believe, in a couple media sources. Mm-hmm. And he put out this book that makes some interesting allegations that involve Bugliosi. And it kind of ties into the JFK case pre-Bugliosi's environment, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. But basically, West got into a series of conversations kind of like Remington with Bugliosi and arguments eventually. Where Bugliosi would be nice to him and then get mad at him when he would find something that Bugliosi didn't want to find.
Right.
And they would just sort of go back and forth.
little meltdown, wait a month, call him back, maybe he forgot about it. Oh, hey, how you doing?
Yeah, nice to him, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so basically one of the things to me that was most interesting, the overall, you know, people can look into it, but to summarize, basically O'Neill believes that Bugliosi lied a lot more about creating the Helter Skelter narrative than a lot of people accept. And he thinks that he lied about it not only just to create the narrative, but that he actually unknowingly, or in some cases knowingly, hid other crimes that might have been connected to a larger pattern in what had happened. So we talked about how Manson kind of was a representative of the evil side of the hippies, and that basically, you know, through things like Operation Chaos and COINTELPRO, the establishment had for a long time been wanting to destroy the hippies, and they were looking for a way, and Manson provided them that way. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting about what O'Neill says is that, so one of the people, a man named Joyland West, was involved in MK Ultra and in, you know, the attempted mind control experiments back in 1954. And according to O'Neill, they used, you know, local they would dose local people knowingly and unknowingly, and that included some hippies and some beatniks. And among the people in the supposed beatnik group that was used by West was Tex Watson.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Tex Watson, as we later know, would be one of the key murderers in the Manson trial later on.
Right.
Now, Manson himself also was known to have been in similar groups, getting dosed knowingly and unknowingly, you know, possibly by Joyland, at Joyland West's behest.
Yep.
Who is working for the CIA, we need to remember. So, what ends up happening is that later on, after the death of Lee Harvey Oswald, Jack Ruby, as we know, people heard him going insane in his cell for some reason and talking about people burning and clawing at the walls and, you know, just acting totally out of character and strange for him.
Screaming that Jews were being murdered just outside of the prison, that there was another Holocaust occurring, and he could hear the screaming at night from this, and he knew that there were other murder groups that were operating on the prison grounds in the middle of the night, trying to commit suicide by bashing his head up against the wall, sticking his finger in a light socket, attempting to commit suicide in this way, allegedly, as well as doing other harm to himself while screeching, screaming, and literally belting out to anyone who would listen all sorts of incoherent conspiracy theories about how he was being targeted and so on and so forth. Yes.
So it turns out that just before Jack did all those things, mm-hmm. he was paid a visit by a local doctor to examine him named Joyland West.
yes.
Who was a specialist from MKUltra who knew how to administer psychotropics to people.
right. And not just psychotropics, but psychedelic psychoactive chemicals.
Yeah.
Psychotropics would be a little different than a psychoactive psychedelic. I'm just saying all these things are there.
Yeah, but he could do any of them. He knew how to affect people's minds with drugs.
Correct. Mind and mood altering substances were definitely in the doctor's bag. That's all I'm saying.
It's interesting that he shows up and is possible contact with Watson, and then Manson under similar circumstances might have been influenced, and then Jack Ruby might have been influenced by the same person.
Uh-huh. And he may have been possibly present in some other places of interest as well.
Well, it just so happens
mm-hmm.
that in 1969, a group of doctors is called in to administer to Sirhan, and among them is Joyland West.
Oh, you mean Sirhan?
Yes.
The alleged assassin, the convicted assassin of Robert F. Kennedy.
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. Just for the note there, not going to elaborate, but go ahead.
A little bit of background on West. He also was later found out to have conducted CIA drug tests in the 50s in Oklahoma at the university. So.
Yes, he was. And there you have it. A guy who was somehow present among these key individuals in history, but also seems to have had a bit of a track record with a whole bunch of names you'll never hear.
And he is, O'Neill basically confronts Bugliosi, who, you know, cuts off conversation and will not discuss any of this, because some of the lies that O'Neill believes Bugliosi perpetrated, on top of the ones we can actually prove, is that he knew about some of these details. He knew that, like, for instance, Bugliosi claimed to have found a videotape which was basically Bugliosi, according to O'Neill, had said that it was just a tape of Roman Polanski and his wife having sex.
Uh-huh.
But what it turned – and that it was suppressed because he didn't want, you know, to put out salacious material. But later on, there were other reports that actually the tape contained Roman Polanski directing men to rape Sharon Tate.
Mm-hmm.
And when you add that to his other behavior that we can verify – that paints a different picture. So was Vince hiding a secret on behalf of Polanski, or was he hiding Polanski's actual crime, which then lends itself to Okay, well, maybe there are other reasons. If men, strange men are being used and brought to this house, maybe that's one of the ways Watson and others find out about it. Maybe these people in some ways are being used to promulgate this larger narrative of the evil hippie and taking advantage of it.
Uh-huh. No, listen, all of that is sensible, and I'll tell you what I'm going to do. We're going to break off the show right here. And it's because we're over time. But if you're on the live stream, I'm actually going to take a couple of extra minutes of your time, if you don't mind, Carmine, because I think we can address some interesting stuff that I'd like to add to the member section and Patreon. But this is a hell of a thing. Vince Bugliosi, reclaiming Vinny Bugliosi, in fact, part three. We'll end it right here, but if you're a member at Ocelli.com or Patreon, or patron, excuse me, at Patreon, you might hear a little more. But this show is all done for the night. Remember, I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. And guess what? You can go over to TPAAK, TPAAK.com. Check out Carmine's work even more. And trust me, you'll learn something new just by doing it. Anyway, that's that. And I'll see you on the other side.